This is where, when I started to go to boarding school as a 10-year-old, this is where I became very aware of actually having quite a lot of shame about where I came from, about my background, about the fact that my family was wealthy and that I could even afford to go to a boarding school. Abundance is an inside job, and your intuition is the key to unlocking it all. Hello and welcome. I'm Rebecca Davison, founder of the Intuitive Life Academy, the leading place to develop your intuitive and psychic gifts. As an ascension guide and light leader, I'm committed to bringing you all the latest tools, developments, and the neuroscience available when it comes to the art of effortless manifestation. This show is for lightworkers and for those who identify that your intuition is your greatest guide to bring you happiness, expansion, and money. With my corporate banking background, you'll receive practical advice along with all the energetic tools that you can apply in your life today. So if this resonates with you, let's jump into the world of abundance and learn what it takes to experience true freedom. Hello and welcome, folks. Rebecca here. You're listening to the Intuitive Abundance Podcast. This is episode 29. I'm really excited to be here today. I'm talking to my own money story. Doing a podcast about abundance, I think it's totally pertinent and relevant for me to share my own experience. I'm actually going to do this in three parts. Part one, I'll focus on my own childhood. Part two, really my employment years, and then part three, what I have created for myself financially through my business. So I'm really excited to share this information. I think it's, as I said, pertinent, relevant. One of the major differences often in my money story, though, compared to a lot of other people's, because when you look out in the collective, there's often a lot of rags to riches stories. And my background, I have to put it on the table straight up, I come from a wealthy background. So that in itself is quite a different experience. So I'm going to speak to that. I'm going to speak to my experience of that. I'm going to break that down in a way that gives you more understanding, because no matter what your circumstances, we are all impacted by society conditioning, familial conditioning, our subconscious beliefs in regards to our own value and relationship to money, and in order to be able to create it and to hold it. So I'm excited to speak to this. Some of you may know that I am an ex-banker, so I'll look forward to sharing more of that experience of working in the banking industry and what I learned about money as well. And then, of course, looking at my own business and what I have navigated through that in terms of my creation, because your business is an amazing container for personal and spiritual growth. I love my business for that reason. It has really been an amazing experience, and anybody who's interested in personal growth often has a natural inclination to being in business, because it's always you against you. So I'm excited to speak to my money story today. Specifically, we're going to focus on my childhood, really. And the question that I asked myself when I was thinking about doing this podcast was simply, what's my first memories or recollections or impressions of money and how that showed up? So I say that I come from a wealthy background, but my parents did come from relatively humble beginnings in terms of their own personal circumstances. So in terms of, you know, I grew up in a little town called Culverton, which is in North Canterbury for those listening from overseas. So I'm based in the South Island of New Zealand, and the city that I live in is Christchurch. So Culverton's probably like an hour and a half from Christchurch, tiny place. Like if you close your eyes, if you sneeze, essentially when you're driving through, you'd pretty much miss it. It's very small. It's a place where people often stop to grab a snack or go to the bathroom on the way to Hamner Springs. But that's where I grew up. First 6-7 years of my life was spent in that place. So one of my first ever memories really of money, interestingly enough, was my mum actually had a gift store and it was called The Clink, which is kind of a funny name, but you have to think this is back, right, in the, you know, the late 70s. So as a child, I was like 5 years old, around about this time. I remember going into the gift store and sitting on her knee and people coming into the store and buying things, right? That they would look around the store and then they would select something and then they would come up to the counter and they would give her money. So that's probably my first ever real experience of the tangible experience of holding money and seeing somebody pass the money over, see my mum take it, see her give them change, see her wrap the gift up and then go on their merry way. So I remember from that experience too, looking at all the stock in the store and just finding, you know, like very curious as children are, excited about what was in there, enjoying that process of discovery, not really having any awareness of how it even came to be there. It did increase my awareness when my parents would actually go away and buy stock for the store, because obviously that impacted me as a child because we went and stayed with other people. That's probably one of my first ever memories. Another memory that I have is going to school. Like I went to a Murray area school and I remember, I think it was called home economics back in those days, but it was actually a class where we learnt how to cook. And one of those classes, they actually made cookies, right? They made biscuits, as they're called here in New Zealand. And we had to take 20 cents. And that's one of the first memories I have as well, is actually asking my parents for 20 cents when I was at school to go and pay for this cookie, and being the person, being the child that was activated around food, for sure, I remembered to ask them for that 20 cents. But the process of asking them, receiving the money, and then taking it to school in exchange for this, and it was, I remember it looked like a mouse, like it was just a round cookie, and then it had like licorice, I think, on it for whiskers and some icing for ice. So there was an awareness, right, that money gets you stuff, right? Money buys you stuff. A not so great memory and experience, one of my first experiences around money, was actually going to the grocery store in Culverton, and I really wanted a box of Pebbles, which the equivalent would be Smarties, I think, in the US, which is like chocolate, you know, chocolate candy that's got a shell or a coating on the top of it and all different colors. Here I am in the grocery store and I'm saying to mom that I wanted this box of Pebbles, and mom's like, no, you can't have it. And I pinched it, right? I stole it. So I remember getting home, and you know, with when you're a child, like as an adult, looking back on your memory, it's often just an image or a slightly blurred image. I remember being under the bed and I remember my sister discovering me, and I remember listening to her as she ran down the hallway and she was yelling out to mom, and she was saying, mom, Becky's got this box of Pebbles. And I remember that sinking feeling of like, oh my goodness, I can't believe she's dobbed me in. Right. So, and bless my mom, right? She actually came and dragged me out from underneath the bed, obviously, told me off, but she got in the car and she drove me all the way back into Culverton. And it must, you know, it's at least a 10-minute drive, or it seemed like it as a child at least. I'm not quite sure how many kilometers that was, but you know, like it was an effort to get back in the car, go down the hill, drive back into Culverton, go to the grocery store, and actually say, this is incorrect. She's, you know, not just done something illegal, but made a mistake, and mum making me apologize and obviously for her to pay for it. You know, and I know that that sounds, from my perception, it sounds like of course she would do that, but I'm grateful that she did, because of course it gave me an awareness that that's not okay. And it's tricky looking back on situations like that too, because it your time has gone by and how you felt about it then, but this is how we start to learn about subconscious beliefs. You know, obviously it was great that she caught me and that she took me back into COVID and made me apologize and paid for the pebbles, because she was demonstrating to me that you don't do that, right? That is incorrect. You don't bypass it. You don't pretend that it didn't happen. You actually take responsibility. So bless her for doing that. But you know, again, one of those experiences where really landed with me. It landed with me that there's a way of being around money that works, and there's a way of being around money that doesn't. I guess too, my experience then at that time was really knowing or identifying that this is right and this is wrong. You know, that awareness can be really helpful and beneficial, but to a point. You know, when it comes to money, absolutely, we don't want to do things that are illegal. We don't want to do things with money that harm other people. We don't want to do things with money that cause distress or, you know, take things without having paid for them. But in terms of other things, we can get really hung up on right and wrong, and we can make ourselves wrong very easily. I think looking back at that circumstance, you know, I was really lucky that I had a mum who took action, took me and put me into the car and took care of it, because obviously I remember it to this day, and I would have been under the age of 5, so quite a wee while ago. But to be the person who has an understanding of that as well. So it's important to review your early experiences of money. Like, what did it feel like? Generally speaking, those are probably more tangible experiences of immediate contact, like tangible as in I had my hand on the box of pebbles and I obviously hadn't paid for it. I had my hand on the 20 cent piece as I took it to school to pay for the cookie. I had my hand, well, probably close proximity to watching mum receive the money when she was in the gift store. But the other thing that wasn't so tangible, which is more intangible, is the environment that you're in. My dad actually built his house, or the house that we lived in as a child, with my grandfather's help. And, you know, my first experiences of being a child, and again, often a lot of this, again, is subconscious, because you're just growing up in that environment. So if I turned the lights on, you know, the lights worked. If I turned the hot tap on, there was hot water there. There was never any awareness or experience of not having money, although I know that at times cash flow was definitely an issue for my parents, especially when they were kind of first starting out. My dad was a farmer, and if you know anything about farming, it's very much tied to the elements. You definitely watch the weather forecast every night. You have to make decisions in terms of noticing what the weather's going to be doing in terms of, right, obviously growing your crops so you can make decisions about your livestock, etc. You know, it's a little bit like a game of chess in regards to how, you know, you're looking at prices for your meat or for your wool, etc., and that, you know, can often determine whether you have a good year or a not so good year. So there is a little bit of an element there of being at the mercy of the market, or, you know, what supply and demand is doing. Obviously, as a child, I had no concept of that, but this is the environment. And again, one thing I knew as a child immediately, and knew my whole life through, that we always watched the news at nighttime, because that was Dad's thing, right? And we would always watch the weather forecast, because Dad wanted to know what was happening with the weather in terms of his farm. So that became a very important part of a farmer's life. It's just, I'm sure everybody who has anything to do with farming will completely understand that, about how important it is to know that information, because it can literally affect your livelihood. So that becomes a priority. But in a more intangible way as well, you know, I didn't have awareness of really what kind of car we had. We had a beautiful Ford Cortina station wagon, and you know, we had a farm truck, etc. But as a child, I just knew that I was provided for. I always felt safe. I always felt provided for. I always felt warm. I always had something to eat. You know, like we definitely had treats. I remember as a child still scraping the chair across the kitchen floor and climbing up on the bench and reaching for the Black Knight licorice that was held in the top of the cupboards. I remember Dad having a big box of, what were they called? Wine gums in his office, and going and opening the door and shoving my little hand in there. Again, these associations with knowing on some level that money has bought that, has provided that, but not having any clues, obviously, of how that has come to be, or, you know, how money came into Mum and Dad's world. Obviously, I had some subconscious awareness of the gift store, but obviously as a child too, you're just like a little sponge. I've talked about this before. You're in different brain frequencies as you're growing up, so you're absorbing your environment. You know, I had that, obviously, that experience of my father and the way he worked. And the way I often knew that is that he often wasn't there, right? Like he would spend a lot of time out of the house. He would often be gone before we got up in the morning, and he often wouldn't come home until after we were in bed at nighttime. So I guess on one level, I was subconsciously making that connection that money means absence or work or hard work. It wasn't necessarily spoken out loud. That was probably like 0 to just on 6 years old. I was 6 going on 7 when I had a major life change, which is when my family moved. We moved from North Canterbury and we moved to Banks Peninsula. And my dad actually, you know, it was a family property. We moved to a property that had been in his side of the family, his grandmother. For, and also obviously beyond that as well, we moved to this property, right? And this property had been in our family for many generations. And what happened is my dad actually raised a mortgage and bought out his great aunt, and then he raised another mortgage to my grandmother. And it was a circumstance where he took quite a big risk with this property that had been in the family for quite some time. And he took his family, he took his wife and 3 small children, and he went over, and this property was pretty run down. It's called Annandale, annandale.com, if you want to look it up now, because it's actually been converted into a boutique hotel. It's absolutely beautiful, incredibly stunning. The homestead itself is where we actually lived. But when we first went there in 1980, it was very run down. It had to be rewired, it had to be replumbed, it had to be redecorated. I think it needed some re-roofing. It needed to be repiled, which meant, you know, the foundations needed to be jacked up and the house needed to be leveled out. So with that, with the redecoration, with the rewiring, with the replumbing, with the re-roofing, with the redecorating, we needed carpet. We were knocking down wall, like my parents did, obviously, knock down walls. You know, they spent pretty much 20 years doing that property up. They were amazing to my folks, because what they did is they had a vision for the property, and incredibly courageous. I can't imagine moving my family, my immediate family, to a property like that, even wanting to do it. To me, looking back at it, it just seems staggering that they had that much courage. They did the children's bedrooms up first to make us feel comfortable, because the house, you know, it was old. It was built in 1886. It was huge, right? Well, it still is huge. If you want to have a look, you can see it still is huge. It's a massive property. You know, when we went there, it had 10 bedrooms and at least 5 bathrooms off the top of my head. It even had an area that was originally a maid's quarters. So it was actually originally a hotel, ironically, where people used to come and stay. The original Annandale homestead actually was lost in a landslide and ended up in the ocean, pretty much in Pigeon Bay. So no, my great-grandfather who came around bought the hotel and then took his family there. So this was the property in Culverton was single level. It was 3 bedrooms, I think. So this was a massive change. People told me as a 6-7 year old, I remember being down at the boat shed, which was pretty much in front of the property in Pigeon Bay, and the local kids telling me that it was haunted. It was run down. If you've ever been in an older property before, it often has a certain type of smell. There were books piled up in a lot of the rooms, pressed against the walls, and when we pulled them away, we realized it was to cover up where the mice had come through. So the property was pretty run down. Like, it had been in the family, but nobody had used it for a period of time, and it was being let out as a holiday home. So it wasn't really being maintained properly. So it was a big step, you know, it was a big jump. And my grandparents actually on my dad's side were really amazing in terms of actually doing a lot of carpentry work and helping my parents, you know, put in new bathrooms and do it up. Really incredible. Knocking down walls, redecorating, wallpapering. You know, I still remember my dad walking in and just being amazed. But it's so funny as a child how you just take things for granted. Like, I can't even imagine knowing how to hang wallpaper. And my dad was brilliant at it. You know, my dad was like a real MacGyver. He was just so amazing at whatever he put his hand to. And you never had any awareness as a kid that he didn't know what he was doing, or because he just did it, and he did it beautifully. He did it perfectly. And it's like, wow, he had an amazing skill set, my dad. Hence me calling him MacGyver. He always had his pocket knife in his pocket and would pull it out and just, I don't know, do something crazy, invent a television and antennae, or pull the bee sting out, or, you know, fix something, cut a pipe to size to be able to make sure somebody had their water supply. But again, it was a massive leap, I guess, too, not just in terms of the actual property, but in my money story. Because one thing that became very, very apparent about moving to that property was not just necessarily my perception of it or my awareness of it. I mean, my first memory really of moving to Annandale was coming downstairs the morning after we had just moved there. And Mum, bless her, had put some fruit on the table, and opening the kitchen door and watching all the mice run off the fruit bowl. So it wasn't for the faint-hearted, let's put it that way. And it was, you know, the house itself, gosh, how many sets of stairs did it have? 1, 2, 3 sets of stairs inside the house. So for a lot of people, it felt a little bit like a maze. Now, when you actually lived there yourself, of course you knew how to get around and where everything led to, and it felt very straightforward because of course it's your home. But for other people, it felt like a little bit of a labyrinth because there were so many rooms, so many corners, so many different areas, and people would often get confused. So it's other people's perceptions too. But a lot of people actually thought when we moved there that we'd tear it down. I think one of the interesting things too is starting to realize at this point in time that my parents were incredibly brave and courageous to go do that, to take on a project of that size, and their dedication and commitment. The other thing that's probably notable to speak to is this property is pretty much right on the waterfront in Pigeon Bay, and it also has an amazing garden. And when we went there, it was overgrown and full of weeds. So not only was this huge house an amazing project, but the garden as well. And my mother spent many an hour in that garden, bringing it back to life. You know, it has a beautiful elm tree on one of the lawns in front of the house. It's got a lot of amazing trees on the property. It is incredible. The garden, my mum and I were fortunate enough to go back and have the gardener take us around. And it is, if you ever get the opportunity to go there, it's stunning. I think it's about $3,000 or $4,000 a night to stay there. But totally worth it, right? Of course, I'm going to say that because I'm biased, but, and it's my original childhood home, but it's stunning. Like, the gardens are amazing. The property itself is incredible. If you're looking for a place to do some kind of high-level luxury retreat or event, incredible location. Stunning, absolutely beautiful, high quality, amazing. Check it out. But again, living there as a child, what I started to notice too, like I said, is other people's perceptions. Because some really interesting things happened when we were living in this property. Number one, one of the things that my parents had to do relatively quickly was actually put in an electric fence, because people would just wander into the garden. And I can understand that to a point, because it was right on the waterfront and people didn't seem to understand that it was private property. But the number of times that my mum would find somebody in the garden, one time she even found a guy who got caught and he kind of froze and pretended that he was a tree. Like, he put his arms out like he was a tree. And mum was like, I can see you, you know, and stuff like that used to happen all the time. But other things would happen, like people would steal plants. We used to have these old coppers, which is what they actually used to wash clothes in the garden. People would come into the garden and steal those. Other really interesting things that happened, of course, is other people's perceptions. Now, and I can appreciate this to a point as an adult, which is when you go drive up the driveway to a huge property like that, of course, you're probably just going to naturally make the assumption that the people who live there are loaded, because the house is huge. And of course, my mum and dad spent a lot of time, energy, and effort, and they did it themselves, most of it, right? What they could. You know, we had an electrician come and live with us, I think for about 6 weeks, right? Because it's a bit of a location, it's about 60-70 minutes from Christchurch. And I still, you know, still remember his laugh. I still remember his attitude and his sense of humor. And he stayed with us for that period of time to rewire the house. So he went through pretty much every room, step by step, checking the wiring, making sure it was up to grade, bringing it up to standard. These different experiences of growing up in this house, but also starting to recognize, and that's really where it impacted my money story, because it was other people's perceptions of this place that made me more aware of my own money story, because it was through other people's perceptions that I was starting to look at what I guess we had. And this is very interesting too, right? Because perception is not always reality. You know, my dad used to have this office. He was actually, you know, we actually had a billiard room, right? Which had a massive billiard table. If you don't know what billiards is, folks, it's a pool table, but it's bigger than a regular pool table, much bigger. Stunning, beautifully covered with green felt, like slate. It's beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful piece of furniture. And my dad actually used to have his office in that room, which I believe is where my great-grandfather used to have his office as well. You know, the thing about living in a property like that, where your ancestors have lived there, you can feel them there, which was really amazing, right? Because they love the fact that ancestors had gone back to the property and was taking care of it. So I always felt safe and protected there energetically and with spirit. You know, they loved us. They welcomed us. And so people were right saying, yes, the house is haunted, but not in a negative context. It was just like, of course they live there. It's their pride and joy. So again, my dad had this office there, but my dad was, you know, he was the kind of person who paid his bills on time. Like, he valued people who worked for him. He made sure people were paid promptly. He took care of business. Right? He wouldn't let, you know, he was often, if he wasn't working on the farm, he was often in his office doing paperwork. I know, even though people had this perception of, oh my gosh, you must be worth so much money, I know that my dad used to often be concerned about making ends meet. But he was so committed to making sure that other people got what was their due. And he would often do that to his own sacrifice, right? He would not go, you know, I don't remember my parents, for example, going on holiday. We lived there for 25 years. I don't remember them going on holiday very often at all. You know, there weren't trips to Fiji's and ski holidays. It was mum and dad working, 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 working. And often what would happen if you live in a property like that, when you have spare time, you're doing something, you're working. And my dad was one of those people who was an active relaxer, which meant that, like, for him, relaxing was probably mowing the lawns, right? There was always a to-do list and always something else to do. It's just kind of natural, I think, to live like that to a certain extent if you're in farming. But he didn't really take any downtime. He didn't take a holiday. He didn't take a break. Very seldom did my parents take time out. So starting again subconsciously to have this awareness, right, that, and I think also too, like, even as a farmer, sometimes there can be a, like, I just don't want to be away from the farm, and so in case something goes wrong, or I don't want to be away from the dogs, or, you know, the dogs need to be fed, I have to get somebody to come in and feed them, or something needs to be taken care of. So there's often a feeling of, like, I need to be there to do it. And again, this is, you know, part of my money story, because I'm noticing this, I'm in the environment of this. And I'm having an awareness of this. You know, this is between the ages of 0 to 10 years old, really, that I'm in this awareness that, you know, we live in this amazing house and it's huge and it's amazing, an incredible experience. But the perception, other people's perception of how much money we had versus what was actually going on, and it was particularly my dad's domain being the, you know, the main breadwinner, that wasn't always the case. You know, I know there was stress. I know there was concern for him. I know he was often contracted around money in terms of wanting to make sure that he was making sure that other people had what they needed, not necessarily taking any holidays for himself, continuing to work and work and work and work and work. And also too, you know, as a child, you don't go, "Hey, Dad, you're working too much," because you just accept that as being normal. Now as an adult, if I'd been there in that context, I would have sat him down and said, "When are you taking a holiday?" Right? Making him aware of that this choice that he's making is not actually serving him. But in his mind, I'm sure his awareness was, "Well, I can't afford to take a holiday, so I need to stay home and work." And again, there is a little bit of a theme of sacrifice here, because of at this point in time, my dad already had 2 kids at boarding school. And then I was 9 going on 10 years old when I went to boarding school. Oh, and that is a whole other world, because that's probably another leap forward in terms of the money story. Because what happens as a kid when you go from a rural school, which has 12 children in the whole school, Pigeon Bay School, I think it's closed now, to a school of, oh goodness knows how many girls, probably at least 500 now, I would imagine, at Sowen House. It was much smaller then though when I went. I think there was probably only, you know, like maybe 30 girls in the boarding house when I went there. Just trying to think how many beds were in each dormitory. Yeah, maybe like 40. Maybe 40 or 50 girls max. Just trying to think how many, like I said, beds in each dorm. It was small, at least. But I still remember that feeling of saying goodbye to my parents, like turning around and walking away from them, and the hollow feeling in my stomach, of course, recognizing that feeling of kind of loss or sadness or homesickness. But at the same time, recognizing that this is an amazing opportunity and not everybody has the opportunity to go to school. So boarding for me, like, it was only an hour and 10 minutes away to live, you know, to board in Christchurch. But driving in and out each day, again, it wasn't really viable to be a day girl. Parents didn't want to drive for 2 hours and 20 minutes every day to come in and pick me up and take me home again. So my brother, my sister and I, we all stayed at the boarding house. Again, the sharper contrast here is where the C word comes into play, and that C word is comparison. As a child, starting to be very aware of what you have and what you don't have, And like I said, perception is not always reality. And I wasn't really interested in a lot of that, but noticing how people were, do you have the right clothes? Right? Do you have the right jeans? Do you have the right toys? Do you have the right accessories? Are you doing the right things? Are you going to the right places on holiday? And I often felt that I didn't really fit into that because the answer to a lot of that for me was just no. I felt a little annoyed that I was supposed to be interested in those things. I wasn't interested in making sure I had a Country Road bag, which is a clothing store here, folks, for those overseas. You know, the right holiday tee or whatever it was, the sweatshirt you were supposed to have. I didn't care. That, in a way, I think perpetuated a sense of isolation because I didn't care and I was therefore removed from the inner circle or the group. Because, of course, when we start going to school, we start learning about these things called cliques. Cliques aren't really that cool. I think a lot of the time people can want to be in the clique and then realize that the clique is just awful. So why have you been desiring to be part of something that's actually going to create more distress or discomfort or unhappiness even? But it was very prevalent at school. What do you have? What do you not have? You know, what's your background? Where are you from? And I guess it was probably at this point in time that it was reinforced in a slightly different way for me in terms of background and wealth. Because one thing that I did notice probably around about this time is, and one thing that maybe separated us out from other people, and it was a really little thing, but looking back, it was a big thing as well. And that was that my dad would get mail and it would say his name and at the end of it, so it would say Frank Davison, and at the end, or Francis Davison, which is his full name. At the end of it, it would say Frank Davison Esquire. So ESQ, which is short for Esquire. And I was like, what is that? Now I know, especially because I just recently looked it up on Wikipedia. I already knew it previously, but to make sure I was quoting it correctly. Here we go. Esquire historically was a title of respect accorded to men of higher social rank, particularly members of the landed gentry, above the rank of gentleman and below the rank of knight. That was one of the key indicators that I knew my family was different from other people. I mean, I knew that already from obviously having the opportunity to go to boarding school. I knew that already from living in a really big house. That was probably one of the, it was a little thing, and obviously it was never seen so many letters with that on the end. And I never really knew what that meant consciously as a teenager. But obviously now as an adult, I'm like, oh yeah, that was one of those clues that spelt out to me that was something quite different, I guess, about my family. And also too, I come from a family on both sides of generational wealth. I'm a sixth generation New Zealander. So my family has been in New Zealand for a long time. People talk a lot about the first four ships in Christchurch. I had relatives here before that. So again, it's more probably coming back to social structure, ancestral money, and even a class system. But folks, one thing I do have to share about this is where, when I started to go to boarding school as a 10-year-old, this is where I became very aware of actually having quite a lot of shame about where I came from, about my background, about the fact that my family was wealthy and that I could even afford to go to boarding school, let alone have two siblings who were also at boarding school. It actually brought it into really sharp focus, and I did not like it. I felt separate, I felt different from other people, especially the contrast of having gone from Pigeon Bay School to somewhere like Selwyn House, because nobody else, as far as I knew, from that area ended up, oh, there was one person in Pigeon Bay I can think of off the top of my head, ended up going to boarding school as well. Do you know what I mean? And getting that feeling of like, you're different than other people. You know, one thing I got told at school by one of the teachers, which I'm sure wouldn't happen now because it was totally out of line, and talk about, again, reinforcing the shame factor. Having a teacher at high school who's yelling at us when she's upset with us and telling us that we're all born with a silver spoon in our mouth, which of course, essentially, again, you don't necessarily consciously know what the meaning of that is. You know it's not good when they're yelling at you. And you also know it's indicative of the fact that you're spoilt or you're entitled or that you've got money, so therefore you're spoilt and entitled and you have no idea about how the real world works. But again, it just cemented another layer of shame. And as part of my money story, to actually go and unpack that. I remember once being out for dinner, and it was a group of people that I didn't really know that well, but somebody I did know was at the other end of the table, and the woman she was speaking to piped up and yelled at me down the other end of the table. I was in the middle of a conversation with somebody else, yelled at me and said, "What school did you go to?" Now, she was actually talking about high school. I went on to another boarding school, and I replied and said St. Margaret's, which is a private girls' school here in Christchurch. And then I very quickly said afterwards, because this is when I'm an adult by this stage, in my 20s or 30s, and I said to her, "Have you put me in a box now?" I was mortified. I was mortified that I was asked that question over the top of a table. I was mortified that I was put on the spot like that. I was mortified that I grew up from a background where if somebody asks you a question, it's incredibly rude not to answer. So recognizing that in this moment, I was actually really angry because I felt like I was being put in a box, or putting it outside of a box, whichever way you want to look at it. But these, again, these energies that impact us, and also too, because I have definitely downplayed it. So let's speak to it, because it's definitely part of the money story that I've had. And that is jealousy. You know, I've had people show up at our family home. And again, when it's your family home, it's very different than other people's perceptions. They might look at it and feel like they're rolling up to something that feels very grand or majestic. But for you, it's just your home. You know, I've had people that I know come up my driveway and their jaw has dropped open because they're like, "Oh my God, is this where you live?" And you can literally see people's estimation, and you're going up in people's estimation, you know. And again, that's not what you want. You want to be seen as somebody independent of what you have. Because, and also too, I think that's probably one of the things that people have maybe struggled a little bit, because I think people have, because my parents, I see them, other people may see them differently, but I see them as very humble, generous people. They had an amazing vegetable garden. So people would come and mum and dad would give them vegetables to take home with. Like, people would turn up and they just have a cup of coffee or whatever. Or eventually maybe my parents did have garden tours, etc. But people, if you turned up, mum and dad would take you into the vegetable garden. They'd give you a whole bunch of beans, tomatoes, whatever they had on hand, lettuces, sweet corn. You would go home with more than you came with, right? They were generous people. They're humble people. They're quiet people. They're private people. They, in my estimation, were not snobs. I never saw my parents lord their wealth over other people. My dad would give you the shirt off his back. My dad was constantly helping other people in the community, especially fixing their water pipes, right? So, which pulled on his time with his family, but he did so because he was a helper. He loved helping other people, and he was happy to do it, right? He was happy to keep the peace. But people were jealous. I remember my mum retelling a story about a woman who came to the house, and mum had just done up this room in the house. We used to call it the big room because they knocked out a wall, and it was actually at the front of the property. At the front of the house has a huge front door at Annandale. And just to the left, as you came up the path from the wharf, came up the path, and you would go into the sitting room. And it was actually separated out for women to go and sit in this little kind of parlor area. And then there was another room that was actually reserved for men, because that's how old the house was. But they knocked this wall out and they made it a big room. I think actually they might have knocked two walls out in that room. Anyway, it was a big room. It had a beautiful fireplace in there. Mum put new carpet in there, obviously with Dad, putting this new wallpaper up, which was kind of like had a, it was looked like green silk. It was really beautiful. It had gold, you know, gold kind of brass fixtures and finishings, and it looked really smart. And Mum had a conversation with somebody about how she had bought Indian cotton curtains, and she'd only paid something like $7 a meter for them, and they looked spectacular. Excuse me. There was one thing about that property is it had a high stud, right? So the ceiling height was much higher than normal, which of course gave it a sense of being quite grand. She had these curtains up and it looked incredible, and one of the women there got really upset because she'd spent a lot more money per meter on brown velvet curtains. So she went home crying because she didn't realize that she could create something that looked really smart and elegant from something that was a really low investment. Again, I think my mum felt awful, right? That unintentionally she had upset this woman because she'd had enough awareness to make a choice that was inexpensive, that worked for her. And back in those days too, like Mum probably made those curtains herself because that's how good she was on a sewing machine. It looked spectacular. And here was the end result. But she felt terrible, right? That she was upsetting somebody through her natural skills and talents. So I actually learnt at a pretty young age that when it comes to money or impressions or perceptions around money, it can trigger people. A lot, folks. Right? My parents were on the receiving end of a lot of very not so nice energy. You know, and I was a kid and I even was very aware of that. Right? I remember one time we had been invited to somebody's place in Banks Peninsula. And I was 11 years old and I said to my parents, I was that intuitive even then that I said, I'm not going, I don't like that person. And they could not make me, right? I was that stubborn that I was like, I'm not going, right? So, and they couldn't force me, they couldn't manhandle me into the car, so I didn't go. So again, being in circumstances where you recognize that people, and of course this, you know, this has been a big theme in my life, has been wanting to look deeper and look at where people are getting triggered, what's going on for them, that they are behaving this way, that they're, you know, why do people get activated? Why are they behaving like that? Why are they responding like that? Why are they being unkind? And starting to understand that this person was making some associations in regards to their own value proposition, that people, when they feel like inferior, they can be really unkind. I'm sure you might have noticed. When people are making judgments about themselves, they'll quite happily judge you too. So a lot of people might look at my money story and go, wow, it sounds, you know, you sound fortunate, wealthy, some people might say entitled, whatever. It definitely comes with its own set of challenges, folks. It is painful when people are unkind and they perceive you in a particular way. I think in a lot of ways it has created a lot of isolation for me, right? Which I've definitely worked through. You know, I've worked on my money story a lot, folks. So I will be sharing more of that in the next couple of podcasts. But again, to be the person who's like, even though this has been my experience, it doesn't have to define who I am and how I'm showing up in relationship to money. And also too, right, like unpacking and making it safe to shine no matter what. Making it safe to be bold, making it safe to be powerful, making it safe to choose wealth, even if it activates and upsets other people. And it activated and upset quite a few people. Right, living in a small community, and my dad would get jibes, my mum would get jibes. You know what I love about my parents the most? It never stopped them. They continued on, right? Like a lot of people just would not have considered doing that much work to create what they did. They really took a rough diamond and turned it into a sparkler. And I'll be forever grateful for having that imprint. I'm not afraid of hard work. I'm not afraid of showing up. I'm not afraid of being consistent. I'm not afraid of other people's opinions, right? So they've really imprinted me in a lot of great ways in terms of creating your desires. My dad showed me that you have to have courage to have your dreams come true. You have to take a risk. You have to put yourself out there, right? And he also taught me that, you know, karma is always pretty much instant. You know, if you do something that is contracted, you're the one who suffers, not the other person, right? Like, and again, this is in terms of jealousy. Jealousy is always impacting the person who's jealous. It's not really impacting the person that you're jealous of. So understanding how energetics and emotional intelligence works and understanding where you stand in relationship to your vision, I think that's what's one of the most important things. So that's very brief, but in a nutshell, I really short money story. You know, probably the biggest turning points are really moving to Annandale and then going to boarding school and being in those environments. And the next step will really be to talk to you about what happened when I left school and starting work and finding employment, etc., and actually being paid. One of my first ever jobs actually was working for Dad in the shearing shed, and I was what you call a rousey, which is where you're the person who, when the shearer is shearing the sheep, you're pulling the wool away and sorting it. So, you know, it gets sent away, and obviously as the farmer, Dad gets paid for it. So, and I remember, you know, that was hard work. We did not have a raised stand, which meant that I had to crouch down on the floor to pick up the fleece. I can still remember to this day waking up the next day of having done a whole day of crouching down and how stiff the back of my legs were. But you know, there's nothing like being paid ever for your first job. I still remember how much I got paid, and it was a fortune, really. But that's what he would have paid a rousey. I think it was like $400 or $500 for a week's work. Back then, that was a fortune to me. That was like, oh my goodness. You know, 15 years old, that probably could have lasted me half a term. And I was grateful for the opportunity. I'm sure Dad wasn't grateful for all the complaining that I did about it. But I was grateful for the opportunity that he had enough faith and confidence in me that, yes, I could do the job. And I did that job. And even though, as I discovered, I'm allergic to lanolin, so my hands got really inflamed. I had to wear sticking plasters on all of my fingers because I had a huge eczema come up. But it was an amazing experience, and I'm forever grateful for that, because again, it was my dad instilling into me that it's safe, right, and good to work hard. Right, to show up 7:30 in the morning until 5:30 at night. They were long days. He had an hour for lunch. It was amazing, amazing opportunity. Having that experience of being paid, and back in those days we were being paid by checks, so you would take it to the bank and deposit it. And again, even my first bank account, again, around the same age, Dad taking me to the bank. I still remember getting my first FBOS card. I remember my dad saying to me in the office, don't ever get in the red. I had no idea what that meant. I just knew it was bad, right? I didn't know that it meant overdrawn. So I used to religiously write out all my transactions, so I always knew how much money I had in my bank because I'd seen Dad do that. So again, a lot of my money story imprinted from my dad and how he handled money. Again, he was the person who paid the bills and took care of things in that respect in our home. So a lot of that imprinting from him. So again, I think that's probably the first part of this podcast series in regards to my money story. I probably will do the next two and then maybe do a fourth one in regards to just really unpacking some of these themes. But again, for yourself, right? Asking yourself, what is my first memory of money? How did I feel about it? Where have I had those experiences of a bit of shame? Like, obviously, I can tell you quite easily about my stealing pebbles experience because I don't have any shame around it because I've forgiven myself for that, right? You get the awareness, you forgive yourself, you make a better choice. But again, where we do have contraction, again, shame in regards to recognizing that I came from a family that had more than others, feeling contracted and even guilty about that for quite a long time. You know, these things impact your ability to step into more wealth. They impact your ability to create more abundance because it's all about your perception, not just necessarily from others, but of yourself. Are you giving yourself permission to be wealthy in a way that works for you, beyond your background? Are you giving yourself permission to be wealthy, free and clear of any money story that you might have? Are you giving yourself permission to create it the way that you want it to be? You know, I am an idealist. I freely admit that. Some people probably think that's a negative thing. I think it's a really positive thing because it means that you believe in your dreams. It means that, yes, you can create it. You just have to create a belief system that works for you in terms of creating it. If you don't have what it is that you want yet, you can create it by adjusting your belief system. And that's why I wanted to share in regards to my own money story. Hopefully you find it interesting and inspiring in terms of looking at your own money story, what comes forward for you, how you feel about it, how you can look at it in a way that, you know, what does my mom think about money? What does my dad think about money? How did they do money? You know, I was really fortunate. I never really saw my parents argue about money. I saw my dad be stressed about it. I saw maybe my dad ask my mum to be more aware in regards to what she was spending. Did they argue about it? Not that I really remember. You know, like my dad was very generous. He used to give us money. So when we were at school, but he would also ask for us to budget it. He would give us money and it would be like, that's it for the term, which is probably part of his budgeting process as well, right? Here's the money. You have to make it last for the next 2 or 3 months. That's what we did. We knew that we couldn't come back and ask him for more. That was just it. So all these little things imprint your story. Alrighty, folks, I think that's it for now. I'll look forward to sharing more in the next episode. This has been super fun for me. Hope you find it beneficial in regards to your own money story. So worth unpacking, so worth looking at. I've seen so many amazing transformations for people when they take back their power from their money story. Money literally shows up in your life when you do this because you're reconnecting to your power. So I look forward to sharing more in the next part 2. All right, folks, lots of love. Bye for now. Bye. Thank you for joining the Intuitive Abundance podcast today. If you've enjoyed the show, please be sure to subscribe and write us a review so we can help other people positively impact their lives. I would really love that. If you're ready to activate the energy of abundance within you, then be sure to go to www.intuitivelifeacademy.com to sign up for our abundance activation process. Until next time, here's to your ever-increasing freedom. All my love. Bye for now.